you have a question, come here, and I'll be happy to give you the microphone.
I have two questions. The first one is, where do folks go to get registered for the Medicaid program? Mm-hmm. Is it the county social mm-hmm. services department? Or it is?
Do you want me, I wasn't sure if both parts are for me. There's one part for me and one part for Robert.
You can answer decide.
That one first. And, yeah. Okay, yeah. So let me answer that first. People have a variety of ways that they can register. The easiest is online. We have a wonderful online registration tool. It's actually a national model called access.wisconsin.gov is the website. The other option is county human service agencies do that enrollment function. But many, many people are finding that they can enroll online, and not just for Medicaid programs, but also for food share. If you're eligible for Medicaid, you're probably eligible for food share. And particularly, again, in a down economy, this is, as I like to say, free federal money from the U.S. Department of Agriculture that goes to help people put food on the table, and that's very important as well.
And maybe this sounds a little socialistic, but the piece that I don't hear is while we try to get hold of the healthcare system, I can't figure out where we bring in, I'll just say it, someone like a social worker or health person who would work with families and guide them toward using the health clinics in a positive way.
Let me start, and Robert may like to add. This, exactly as you described, this is one of the advantages of working to reform the way we pay for healthcare. So right now, you know, I have doctors say to me, I really needed to spend an hour talking to this patient and her family about her situation, but I don't get paid for that hour. We have hospitals that employ, you know, little fragments of time of social workers and emergency departments trying to help connect people to better places to get their care. One way to imagine this is, suppose a payment is made to a health system for the care of a patient for a year. So if a person is a diabetic, here's a payment that goes to you, Dean Healthcare, to pick an example, to care for this patient for a year. You spend that money however you want to. So some of it's gonna go to doctors, some of it's gonna go to social workers, some of it's gonna go to nurses, some of it's gonna go to specialists. And at the end of the day, it all is designed to make sure that that person can be as healthy as they can be. So I think that the sort of short answer is the better health systems in the state and the country have figured out that it's not just about the doctors and the nurses. It's also about the dietitians and the therapists and the social workers and the others who connect people to care. What we need is a payment system that makes it easier and creates more incentives for more systems to behave that way.
And as long as I have the floor. And that is not included in any of the health care bills that we have right now, is it?
Well.
Demonstrations.
What is they didn't, it would have been very politically hard to put all that in the bill. People don't want Congress making those decisions. Even progressives don't want politicians in Congress making those decisions. So there are a lot of pilot programs, and there are also a lot of, there's a lot of authority given to the Department of Health and Human Services nationally and various expert commissions to create new payment systems that would do that. Now, how successfully that all happens will depend on how well the process works. There's no guarantee in this, but there's a lot of authority given to create new payment systems that would lead to what you're talking about exactly. You would want, I mean, you could potentially, it's sometimes called a capitated rate, give a health system a certain amount for a diagnosis. You'd also need some sort of accountability where they're getting money for outcomes. Mm-hmm. And so you'd need comparative effectiveness research that wasn't just on a procedure, but was on holistically how you deal with a particular diagnosis in a particular patient and how you coordinate all of their care. And so it's going to take a while to do this. We know it's successful, more successful in some health systems than others. We have some of the more efficient systems in the country. Not in Milwaukee, by the way, unfortunately, but certainly the Madison health plans and also in Wausau and Eau Claire and La Crosse area have some very, very good ones. But it's going to be very complicated to change all the incentives in the system. But these bills are set up to create the conditions for doing that and to create those policies over time. But it'll take a while.
I'm interested in, is it on?
Yeah.
I'm interested in the healthcare insurance increases for nonprofits.
And I wonder how much of the relief is in, for small business is envisioned to be tax subsidy, and how much is actual competition bringing prices down, and what might help nonprofits?
There are specific provisions for small businesses where they get up to a 50% tax credit to provide insurance, and they are the first ones to be able to get onto the national health insurance exchanges. You start with 25 employee and less small businesses, and then it goes up gradually. So there's a big emphasis on small businesses. For nonprofits, there's also there's a 25% subsidy because they're not taxed in the first place. So there's no tax to cancel out. And so small nonprofits would also get immediate relief, and that's relief that starts before you have full implementation. So there is an emphasis on that, and those are small businesses and small nonprofits are among the most vulnerable right now.
But my concern is also for the fact that people that are in personal care often have large numbers of employees because it's very labor intensive. So they're not small in the definition of number of employees, but they're poor. Mm-hmm. Is there any relief for them?
There are provisions in the bill to really emphasize on investing in community-based services. So those would affect that because people want to remain independent as long as possible, right? And there's other reforms, including working at the state level, to do that as well. But you need to invest in that workforce. Those are very low, and it's not all in this bill, but it's part of a lot of what people are working on. You need to invest in that workforce and make those higher quality jobs in order to have retention and keep the best caregivers. And so I think that's very, very important. There's a little bit about it in this bill, but there's also a lot of discussion nationally in the state about doing more.
Right.
Yeah, you're right.
Hi, my name is Ron Dunzel. I don't know if this is working. It's not working, right? I have a question, but first I have a brief announcement. Just tell everyone that on Saturday, February 20th, there is going to be a conference festival at Wisconsin Heights High School about 15 miles west of here, between Black Earth and Maisel Meade, and we will have Congresswoman Tammy Baldwin, we will have Senators Mark Miller and John Erpenbach, and we are going to be discussing health care reform in Wisconsin and hopefully establishing an agenda, beginning an agenda, of advocates and legislators, and I would love to have both of you there too, especially Robert. I think you'd be phenomenal as a participant in that kind of dialogue. Karen, you're going to be, you would be a very interested party in that too, and so we'd love to have you. But I know Dr. Farley's going to be there, and several other people I see in the audience. So I've got some flyers in the back there if you'd like to pick up on that, and I think it's going to be a great thing. My question is, I understood, based on conversations this afternoon, that Senator Feingold is opposed to using the reconciliation process. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry? That's what I've been told by people in his inside his campaign, as well as John Erpenbach, the senator. Does anyone, do you have any sense of that?
I mean, I've been at the Capitol all day. If he made a public statement, I hadn't seen it. I was in his office talking to his top healthcare person Thursday, and they didn't mention that. And in fact, we talked through how reconciliation would work. He might be opposed to certain uses of reconciliation. For example, what happened originally, budget reconciliation could be used to either increase or decrease a budget. And so the Bush tax cuts were done through budget reconciliation when the whole purpose originally, the intent had been to reduce budgets, which certainly Russ is a fiscal hawk. They passed a rule in 207 to say it had to actually reduce the budget. So it might be that he doesn't want to see it abused and see it lead to something that costs more. So he would expect to see, for any increases in it, compensatory decreases. But if there's something more, I mean, he's very involved in these issues. If there's something more that he said today or taken a position today, I don't know about it.
But it might be something people would want to check.
Yeah, that would be problematic if that were the case.
I have two questions. One for Dr. Dr. Craig. My short-term memory does not permit me to remember what it was you were talking about, but you mentioned something the government would be doing for people, $50,000 and up income, and then what the policy would be from $30,000 to $50,000. And my sense is that poverty level and low income are not necessarily the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What about the people who are low income, under $30,000 a year? Do you remember what it was?
Yes, I think so. So there's kind of a continuum on how coverage is done in these bills, both the House and the Senate bill, and the likely combination of the two. For people who are in the House bill, 150% of poverty and below, they would be eligible for Medicaid, which would be mostly paid for by the federal government. For people above that, they would be in in the case of the Senate bill, it'd be state health insurance exchanges where you choose between private plans or the basic benefit packages, and there'd be subsidies on a sliding scale based on income to make it affordable. And what I was referring to with the people 50 and up and between 30 and 50 is that the House and the Senate did it very differently, and this is partly what has to be combined through budget reconciliation. The Senate was more generous to people in the middle, upper middle segment, gave them better subsidies. The House bill was more generous to people in the lower part, right after Medicaid eligibility, up to $50,000 of income. And so progressive advocates such as us think that the House version is better because you'd actually have to pay a surprisingly high percentage of income for modest income people in the Senate bill. But the best approach of all would be to adopt the House's approach to people of modest income and the Senate's approach to people at middle income and above. And that's what we're hoping can be done through budget reconciliation.
My question is still, what about the people with the low income? How would their subsidy be handled? Because
the lowest people would be covered by Medicaid.
They would have to be a poverty level to be covered by Medicaid.
150% of poverty in the House bill. The next group would get the exchange, but they'd get affordability credits based on income, so they would get much more affordability credits than people up. It's on
a
ladder.
You're still talking about the $30,000 and up.
I'm talking about everyone who's not on Medicaid. You're either on Medicaid or you're eligible for these credits.
So you make $29,000. Yeah. And I believe 150 of poverty would be something like 21,000. So between,
for an individual, higher for a family.
That's
so
21
between
is
that
200
and the 30,000, those are the people who fall in cracks because
they would get much higher subsidies. They're progressive on a sliding scale.
Okay.
We just have to make sure they're sufficient, and the House bill's better at that. So they would get much larger subsidies. That's the answer.
Question.
But if we have the Senate version, the subsidies aren't enough for those people, and you're absolutely right. We need to correct that in this process.
Okay, I understand you now.
Sorry, it's all very complicated, so
it's not. Karen, and this is a much simpler question.
Oh, good.
On the first page of the Badger Care Plus, you have adults, a family planning waiver.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is that open, is it a separate insurance, or do you have to be in one of the other programs to be entitled to that? I'll sit down.
It is a separate program. You can enroll only in the family planning waiver, and the design of it is simply that both women and men now, we just in the last budget expanded it to include men because it turns out they have something to do with this process as well. Both women and men between the ages of 15 and 44 are eligible for the family planning waiver.
Okay, I think I can speak loudly enough without this.
No.
Okay. Is it working now?
Yeah.
Good. Let me introduce myself. My name is Fritz Lowenstein. Thank you. My name is Fritz Lowenstein. I'm a physician. And I'm astonished at the complexity of healthcare in this country, because it doesn't need to be. And what stands in the way? Yeah, I don't mind applause. What stands in the way? I think some of the worst offenders are the insurance companies, and despite your efforts to put wings on them, it won't work. Insurance companies have generally stood in the way of reform in health care. They've done much more harm than good. And in fact, I believe, and most experts believe, that there's no place for insurance companies in health care. There's no place for profit making. Yeah. To these important facts.
Do you have a question? Do you have a question?
Yes.
Well, no, my question is, why can't you point to these deficiencies and ask these questions and point to the fact that the insurance companies have done much more harm than good? That profit making does not belong in health care. Because if we look at the example of other Western countries, and what is it that they have that we don't have? They have universal health care. And I'm going to be accused of being a socialist, a Norman Thomas man, but sometimes socialism is good. And the republics have tried to paint the word socialism in a bad way, but socialism often is a very good thing in a society. And the word society, in fact, reflects socialism. So we need to have universal health care in this country, just as is present in most other Western countries. The cost to the society would be much less than the patchwork system that we have now. And as I say, the only thing that really stands in the way is the insurance companies. And when polls have been taken in the public, it turns out that most people in this country are in favor of having universal health care. So why don't we have it? It's because powerful interests stand in the way who are opposed to the public welfare.
Sure. Look, I agree with your values about where it'd be good to get. The question is the political question of how to get there. It's actually, and I think you know this, but there's a diversity of models in other developed countries. A number of them have private health insurance. Germany does, Japan does, Taiwan does, but they don't have for-profit. And in fact, the problem is not just private insurance. You can have universal health care and private insurance. The problem is the business model of our for-profit companies, which, I mean, we've spent most of our time in this campaign focusing on that. That's the people's anger about that is one of the main things that's pushing the reform movement forward. In fact, our organization, Citizens Action Wisconsin, we support single payer. We just don't exclusively support it. We also support other things we think could also achieve a great improvement in our society. But we do think single payer would be good if we could get it. But you've seen in our current political structure that we couldn't even get with a new popular Democratic president and huge majorities in Congress a modest public option in the bill, let alone a universal single-payer position. And part of the reason is that although you will, if you poll the public, they would generally support that position. You might get 52% for single-payer, 55%, maybe a little higher in some polls, that there's a huge mushy middle that once the major attacks are made on it, which will be funded by the insurance industry because they are a major interest in our society, that support will crumble. And so what we can get through now, probably the best bill we can get through now, is something like the House bill. And I completely respect people who think that that's not good enough and that we should not do it. It's my opinion that we would, if we fail in this current effort, that we'll be 15 years before we can do it again. It'll be like 1994, where we stigmatize the idea of healthcare reform, and that in the process we will lose something that would be a major advance and would help a lot of people. And so honest people can disagree on that, but I guess I'm a progressive, but I'm a pragmatist, and I think that we can make a great step forward, even though it's not everything that I would do if I got to just write what the society did.
The funny thing is that reform of health care is a pragmatic step. There's no conflict there, as you have tried to paint. No, there is no conflict. Universal health care should be considered a right. It's not a privilege, it's a right, just as food and shelter. That everybody deserves to have, poor and rich. and that should be supplied by humane and kind society. That's my view.
Let me give one other example. We never got a consensus in this country to abolish slavery. It happened during the Civil War. Abolitionism didn't succeed. The effort to block its expansion is what succeeded. That's what Abraham Lincoln was elected on, and that actually led ultimately to the abolition of slavery. I would have been, there were some people who said, if you don't abolish it, you shouldn't do anything. I think I agree that you would do what you could, in that case, block its expansion and try to make that a step towards abolishing it. And so I think honest people with the same values can disagree on what the right strategic step to take is. But I personally think we should enact as strong a foreign bill as we can right now when we can, and then build on it.
I got a mind to ask either of you, who thinks this incentive pay for doctors who have healthy patients can succeed? Who?
Could you repeat that question? Could you
move forward? I'm asking either of you, who imagines or who thinks that this payment incentive for physicians who have healthy patients can succeed? Is that used in any of the countries that have better health care than the United States?
One answer would be there are versions of it at work today in some of the fully integrated healthcare systems in Wisconsin. So, for example, a healthcare system that includes the doctors, the hospitals, and the insurance company, while we still do have them, when all of those groups work for one entity and there's a capitated payment made to them that goes for the care of the patient, we see better health outcomes, we see more cost-effective care from those systems than we do from some of the more fragmented parts of our state where you've got doctors not related to hospital, doctor in hospital not related to insurance company, and everybody's out for their particular piece of the pie. And so that's, you know, one small example where we do see it work. We're at the state level working to pilot in as many places as we can rewards for better health outcomes for things like increasing rates of childhood immunization, better management of people with asthma, better management of people with diabetes. We're going to work on paying more for better birth outcomes for high-risk pregnant women, and we have seen already that when we've done that, results do improve.
Yeah, I think it's very complicated to do, and we'll have to keep working on it. There's a good documentary on Frontline called Sick Around the World that looked at a couple different healthcare systems. It's very, very good. You can watch it online and see what they do in Germany versus France versus England versus Japan. It's very, very good. I think the insurance industry, I agree with the last speaker, is a major impediment to this. In fact, Karen's department has had a devil of a time getting the insurance HMOs in Milwaukee to actually meet any quality benchmarks whatsoever. So I do think that complicates matter because it's not in the insurance company's interest, really. In fact, they've profited greatly from hyperinflation by getting the same percentage cut of a larger pie, and I think that's increased their profit. So I think it's going to be a continuing fight to get them to reinvent the way they do things, because they haven't shown any particular interest in improving the delivery system.
And just to finish that story for you, Robert's exactly right that we have had those challenges. And so what we're doing now is putting the whole Medicaid program in the southeast part of the state up for bid to insurance companies that can meet our much stricter quality standards or lose about 3.25% of their capitated rate, which may not sound like a lot, but it's a higher percentage than any other state puts at risk. And part of the feedback we got from the health plans when we met with them was almost in these words, you haven't made it worth our while to this point to work on quality. And we said, okay, we'll make it worth your while. And so we're gonna do that.
I understand from your comments that through reconciliation, the public option will probably not be put back in, correct?
Walking around Congress last week, there seems to be no appetite to take it on. I wish they would, because there's certainly 51 senators, but it doesn't seem to be in the cards right now, unfortunately.
So that was supposed to be one measure for cost control and for competition to kind of keep the insurance companies honest. So does that mean now there isn't going to be any way to do that, or are there other ways that there's the possibility of cost control?
There are other ways through payment system reform. I think having the mechanism of the insurance industry competing with a public program would have been better. And I think it puts more onus on all of us to enforce the new regulations, because the insurance industry will go all out with their new with their new profits, because they'll have a lot more people in the system paying into them to try to weaken all the regulations in this bill and to fight any kind of cost containments that they don't like. And so it simply, it needs a larger battle. I think it would have been easier to keep them honest with the public option, unfortunately, and we fought very, very hard for that. And just because of the nature of the U.S. Senate and the 60 votes, it was not, unfortunately, possible. And now the Senate, Congress is so cell-shocked, they don't want to take on any other controversial issues in the bill, unfortunately.
I don't think we should overlook, though, the potential of the exchanges and just the value of competition. So two things to say about that. One is it's going to matter the numbers of people who are covered by the exchange. The more people, the better, because that will create even greater incentives for insurance companies to come in and really play ball, because they'll have a bigger potential share of the population to scoop up. Those of you who are state employees or who have been state employees in the last couple of years know that we did something exactly like this with the state employee health plan, where we said there are 21 insurance companies around the state who, HMOs, who provide care to state employees. So this is statewide, right? So in any given market, it's not even that many people except here in Dane County. And what we did with the Department of Employee Trust Funds was to say state employees are going to pay less for the most efficient, high-quality health plans that we have, and they're going to pay more for the more expensive health plans. And wouldn't you know that the insurance companies found a way to cut their own throats and reduce their bids and get themselves into that lowest tier where they knew all the people were. And that change, you know, doesn't sound sexy and interesting, but it has made a great deal of difference to the state budget, frankly, while still guaranteeing that state employees have had access to very high-quality health care. So it can work.
Well, one other thing on that that's important, we should not, and we mentioned this before with the other developed countries that have nonprofit insurance, we shouldn't underestimate the distinction between for-profit and nonprofit insurance. What they did, and this is, we do an annual report on the cost of healthcare around the state, and I look at the state employee plan very carefully because it does bids all over the state for the same product. They started looking at quality this year, and so what they did is they not only surveyed all of the state employees about their experience with the health insurance plans that they deal with, they also looked at quality measures like the number of immunizations, other preventive care, chronic disease management, as they saw in claims. And what they found is that the national for-profit companies had 1-star ratings out of 4, almost across the board on major quality measures. So that's Anthem, Blue Cross, that's United Healthcare, that's Humana. And that the nonprofit provider-driven networks, the Dean Cares, the Group Health Cooperatives, the Gunderson Lutheran, the Security, which is the Marshfield Plan, the Health Traditions, which is the Mayo Plan, had 3- and 4-star ratings. And so there was this vast difference between them, and we have good research in Wisconsin to show that. Now, the Senate plan did add that there have to be national nonprofit options that come off the federal employee plans. And in addition to that, that the local and regional nonprofit plans can be in the state exchanges. And so that kind of competition is very important. And what we really need to put pressure on is the large national for-profits. They are much worse than the nonprofits. As much as like a public option, we're going to be left with that distinction, I think, and that competition as a way to drive quality.
Okay, one last quick question. What can we do? Would it be helpful? You know, who should we lobby, basically? Who should we be talking to get this thing finished up?
At this point, if you want them to pass an improved version of the Senate bill, then it's very important to call Senator Cole, Senator Feingold, and you're on the Madison area, Congresswoman Baldwin. I think that we tend to overemphasize swing votes in the legislature or in Congress and just focus on them and not realize that even people who are strong supporters like Tammy Baldwin are encouraged and fight that much harder when they hear from their constituents. And we need energy level. We need the champions not to be dispirited, but to feel like people are behind them in this final part of the fight. So I think calls and letters, even to people we know will vote right, are very important to the legislative dynamic. And then, you know, there could be changes that would call into question parts of the bill for Senator Cole. And we even heard something from an audience member about Senator Feingold and the reconciliation process, which is a concern. So they should be hearing from us as well. But I think that right now there need to be as, in fact, the national kind of reform movements and organizations right now are focusing as much on the supporters as in the doubtful votes for that reason.
I just want to speak up because I think what Robert says, we have to pass something. And obviously liberals, progressives, as well as conservatives have always been against something they say isn't politically feasible. So as what was suggested was the best wasn't politically feasible, so let's try the good, and we're finding the good isn't politically feasible. The Republicans and the right-wingers' job is to destroy. That's been ever since I entered practice years ago. And now we finally may be getting at least a building permit. I put it that way. We've never been able to get a building permit saying our federal government should be involved in setting some standards. And we have to get that building permit. Then we have to work like the Dickens after this gets passed to keep improving it, improving it, improving it, so the house that is being built is better than we expect. But we've got to do it, because if we let this go, then we're licked for another how many years? Bismarck got it from Germany because he was a dictator. Teddy Roosevelt couldn't get it here because by the time he got action, that we were at war with Germany, and they said, well, that's German, you can't do that. So ever since, it's been communist or socialist or something terrible, and now it's supposedly a money breaker because you save money. But anyway,
right.
We got to get this.
I just have a couple of comments. One is that I am really proud to be in the state of Wisconsin and really give credit to you and Governor Doyle and others who have worked to piece all of these things together to provide for the vast majority of people in this state. One aspect of the federal bill that you didn't mention or talk about was the possibility of buying into Medicare for the early retirees or some other method by which those of us who are either ready to retire or involuntarily retired, which I fall into that category of being downsized and having to shop for insurance that will bridge between now and when I'm eligible for Medicare. And it was a very interesting experience. age bias, you know, labeling, both my husband and I is having chronic illnesses and not being insurable. Because there's going to be some bridges that have to be built to 2014 or whenever some of these things can fall into place, HRSA was the fallback. And I haven't heard anything about that high-risk insurance pool being maintained in Wisconsin for the purpose of helping with some of this bridge. I don't know what the commitment to that is, and what those of us who are going to be further out all the time in our eligibility for Medicare are going to do. So, but again, I don't want to disregard any of the work that we've been doing and what we can hopefully achieve by Easter.
Right. The buy-in didn't stay, did it?
Right, no. A while out. And
that's
I know,
first, and I can do HRSA. But
yeah,
you can do Medicare
quickly, the Medicare buy-in looked like there was an agreement in the Senate to do it, and it would have been better in a lot of ways than the very weak public option that was left. And they did it in part because Senator Lieberman has been promoting it for years, including just a month on television prior. And then Senator Lieberman decided after it was announced that he was going to oppose it, probably for malicious reasons, I'm guessing. And so that fell at the wayside for a day or so, or a couple days. We thought that that was going to be a great thing because that group from 55 to 64 is especially vulnerable. It doesn't seem to be in the offing now, which is very disappointing. It also would have expanded single payer essentially down, further down in the age group, because Medicare is a single payer plan. On HRSA, maybe Karen can talk about the state level. In the Senate bill, there is a HRSC program that is supposed to exist and be a bridge to 2014 when the exchanges are created. So they do create a national HRSC program that would be better funded than the current state program. And so that is part of, and it's high-risk pool for people who can't buy affordable private insurance. So that is part of these bills, and it would start right away. It would start this year if these bills pass.
And so, while I will have to confess to not having read all of the fine print, what I would say is that goes on the list of those important decisions that the state is going to have to make. So presuming, again, that what's going to be in the federal bill will be a floor and not a ceiling, if the Wisconsin HRSC program looks better, I think we can assume that the next legislature and the next governor would be expected to continue it, or, you know, could be lobbied to continue it. If there's some advantage to going with some version of what's going to be done federally, then obviously we would do that. But Wisconsin is a state which some states do not have a high-risk pool, as you're describing, and it does provide some help for some people. It is very expensive.
Yes.
Absolutely right. No, it's by no means, by no means ideal. But again, it's in that sort of gap filler category.
You did not mention my insurance company as nonprofit or for-profit, which is WPS. Mm-hmm. And do they have a rating?
They were in the middle. They did not have as good a quality rating as your kind of provider-based nonprofit networks like Group Health Cooperative, but they did have a substantially better rating than the for-profits. And I think one of the reasons for that is that rather than provide the network themselves, they have to operate in the same statewide terrain and compete for business with those national non-for-profits, and they probably are forced to operate more in that direction simply because otherwise they wouldn't get any business from employers, I think. They are nonprofit. And they have some very good progressive people on their board. They're closer to the for-profit model simply because they don't run their own provider network. So in Milwaukee, they've had huge disputes with Aurora, and in fact don't have Aurora in their provider network and haven't gotten much benefit out of that. We're looking at them as a carrier, but there's less they can do about the market. A Group Health Cooperative can change the whole delivery system because they are an integrated network.
And then I see in both the Senate and the Congress plan that Medicare is going to get cut to bring up some of the revenue that they need. And so I'm wondering if you guys know what's going to be cut in Medicare, because a few of us are on Medicare.
The intent is not to cut Medicare at all, benefits at all. It is to change the delivery system and the payment system to save money in Medicare. The only cut that you could call a cut is that there's this Medicare Advantage program where people can buy private insurance, and they, under the Bush administration, put in these huge subsidies to the insurance industry, which means it costs taxpayers a lot more than the regular Medicare program, and that extra subsidy the insurance industry got cut off. They're trying to foment a lot of fear among seniors that they'll lose their plans that they like in Medicare Advantage. They need not, but of course the insurance industry may even start cutting some of those plans simply to foment opposition to reform. But in terms of the overall benefits package, it's all savings based on the payment system and quality. It's not any cut in the benefits.
What about provider rates, though? Isn't there a physician rate cut that's coming?
That is, as I understand it, and you track this, I think that's outside of this reform bill, but Congress continually, and this is why you need to put the process outside of Congress, votes for cuts to providers down the road to save money, and then there's emergency before they actually go into effect and they rescind it. Mm-hmm. And they go through this pattern. And so we seem to be on that pattern again, which is why the whole question needs to be outside of Congress, similar to how we decide to close military bases.
I'm a resident here, and I came with a certain amount of interest this evening, and I have much more interest now, and I'm even slightly optimistic. And I want to congratulate the League of Women Voters on setting up this meeting and on their choice of speakers, people who know what's going on and can speak clearly and with clear articulation, and it's very encouraging. What you said, and I was particularly amazed because, Director Craig, you came from Washington, with good news.
We had the first for every part.
Senate, including the Senate Democrats, and what else? Massachusetts, and the panic that has struck the what's called the Democratic Party. I don't know what there's there. Guys running for cover in every direction. And nevertheless, you are somewhat optimistic. I'm amazed and hopeful. I only just one. That's lead in, but the question is very, very focused. It's very narrow. One thing I was surprised when I first heard about it, and I was surprised when you mentioned it again, and that is there are these components in the Senate bill that don't become operative until 2014. Why on earth? And has that been challenged seriously, or is there any hope it might be challenged? It seems to me the longer things are delayed, the more dangerous they'll never be accomplished.
I agree with you entirely. The House at 2013... you know, they implemented Medicare in the 60s in 6 months, I believe. This is more complicated, but it doesn't seem like it should be that long, and I think it's probably a political idea of moving it beyond certain elections than anything else. There doesn't seem to be a discussion of moving it back, at least not very far, maybe to 2013 like the House did. I think there ought to be. I've not heard, and I've been tracking this very closely, any good explanation as to why it would take that long. As for the positive thing, what you have to remember is, I think, that you know we're the only advanced industrial country without a comprehensive national health care reform system, and we've never even had a full bill on the floor of Congress. And so to remember how far we've gotten in this process, and both houses have passed bills, actually doing this, not a perfect bill, but a bill that is comprehensive, it is very close, and victory on that is within our grasp. And so if you take a step back, you know, we're going to forget about the Massachusetts election fairly quickly. If we can do this, people forgot about the August town hall meetings where some very angry people from the far right came out and took over meetings and yelled at members of Congress, and everyone said healthcare was dead, and by a month later, it was very alive again, and that had dissipated. So we just need to take a step back and see where we are and have some perspective. So,
This is just a postscript. One of the main reasons why I was rather pessimistic coming in, of course, is the abject failure of our president to communicate with ordinary people and spell out half as clearly as you did what was needed in healthcare. He doesn't seem to know how to speak simply to ordinary people. We have to hope and pray that he's shocked or panicked or something into learning how right now.
We have one final question. Sorry.
Thank you.
I only had one question until you said WPS was nonprofit. And I want to question why would nonprofit cost more than any of the other insurance plans? But you don't have to, don't count that as a legitimate question. My real question is that Congress is talking about taxing insurance, what you pay for your insurance benefits. People of higher income, and I'm not sure what the criteria is. That's my question is, what is it, how much insurance you have that makes you put you in the category where you get taxed, or is it how much you pay for the insurance? In other words, somebody who has a lifetime limit of, say, $1 million, as opposed to someone who has a lifetime limit of $5 million. Mm-hmm. Is that what?
It's the actuarial value of the plan. So if the value of the coverage is $25,000, I believe is the current limit, although I think they're working to try to increase that a little bit. This was sort of the labor union dust-up that happened a week or three ago, that labor unions were concerned that they had negotiated increased benefits instead of wages, and if those more valuable plans, we could call them Cadillac plans, we could just call them more valuable plans, if those are taxed, that's to the disadvantage of the labor unions and their workers who bargained for them. And so I think there's an effort to raise the ceiling on that, the rubber may
have
the
latest.
What do you mean by the limit? Because you should increase
the actuarial value.
The value of the plan.
Yeah.
So
is the value of the policy what you can collect?
No, it's the premium, what the employer pays.
It's the premium, and actually they made a change. Originally going to tax the individual with high cost policies, now they tax the insurance company, but they figure that will be passed on. And so it was $23,000, it might be $25,000. It was going to be worked out in conference committee, now it has to be done through budget reconciliation. And it's probably going to go up, but that's going to make the bill cost more, and therefore they're going to have to find other funding measures, which is where Senator Feingold comes in. The Senate's been unwilling to do what the House did, which is simply tax wealthier Americans to fund the health care bill, which was very popular, but the Senate's a millionaires club. They don't like it as much. That may need to happen in order to balance off changes in the quote-unquote excise tax, the tax on higher cost health insurance plans.
Thank you very much.